This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
That's Donald Trump at his inauguration last week. How will this policy affect the rest of the world? Our first two stories today explore this question. First, we're going to talk about Europe, especially Germany. America's involvement on the continent has held things steady there ever since World War II. What will happen once Europe is left to look after its own interests? Trumpet writer Richard Palmer has some insights into why this might be the most concerning question the world faces right now. And second, we're going to look at Israel. After meeting with President Trump this past Sunday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu started making announcements that demonstrate quite a lot of confidence that he has a real friend and ally in America now that Barack Obama is out of office. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about what he's doing and how this will affect Israel's future. In our third segment, we'll talk about music and how to enjoy it more. Ryan Malone is director of musical activities at Herbert W. Armstrong College. He's the host of another show on Trumpet Radio, Music for Life. We're going to talk to him about his show and how we can get a richer, fuller experience from the music we listen to. And I'll conclude the program today with a message to men on the number one thing that will help make you a better husband and father. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Donald Trump has taken office, and in his inauguration, he put the world on notice that his administration is going to take an America First approach. Well, how will the rest of the world respond to this? Perhaps the most important part of the world to watch regarding this question is Europe. So let's talk about Europe, especially Germany. We have via Skype from our office in the UK, Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So I'd like to start by just talking about how important America has been to European policy since World War II, and especially German policy. Maybe you could just give us an overview of, say, the past 70 years.
Right. The past 70 years in terms of European history have been absolutely unique. You know, at no point ever, well, with the possible exception of maybe the Roman Empire, have you had so much peace in Europe. And that in large part is because of the United States. The United States has been there with a security umbrella. So it has been protecting Europe. It's meant that Europe hasn't had to bear the brunt of the burden in defending itself. It has meant that European nations haven't had to build up kind of world-class armies the way they have in the past. It has therefore, that has gone a huge way towards keeping Europe relatively unified, because if Europe isn't building up world-class armies, you'd no longer need to be afraid of your neighbor's world-class army. So just by preserving the peace there, they've done a lot. And then economically, you know, they rebuilt Europe after World War II, the Marshall Plan, that huge investment of funds. But then also just by taking responsibility for global free trade, both in terms of just the actual, you know, keeping the sea lanes open, having that navy patrolling, taking care of threats that could upset that, but then also politically as well, and just pushing this environment where you have open trade, where free trade is kind of considered the norm. Again, that's rare in terms of the long view of history. And this American upholding of trade has opened up this era of huge prosperity for Europe as well. So security for Europe, and then just security for Europe's economy, and helping to lead to this age of prosperity. And so you've had this just very unusual time for Europe, where no nation has really had to aggressively assert and push its own interests the way that nations normally do. And that especially applies to Germany, because, you know, throughout all of this time, Germany's foreign policy in general has been to just take a back seat, to not be really engaged in the pursuit of power politics, and instead just engage in economic growth. And there's good reason for that, because if Germany, say, in 1947, 48, or the 1950s, 1960s, had really started throwing its weight around, started progressively bullying countries, pushing for its own way, really been assertive, well, then the rest of the world, and especially Europe, would have, you know, alarm bells would have started flashing, sirens going off, the world would start to get nervous. So German foreign policy has kind of been a no-brainer. America's taking care of our interests. The rest of the world's going to get annoyed if we really start pursuing our interests anyway. So let's just take a back seat, focus on being prosperous, focus on building our economy, and just let America, we'll just sit in America's shadow.
And NATO was really a big part of that. It was famously said that it was intended to keep the U.S. in and keep Germany down and keep Russia out. And so there was definitely, after World War II, a strong, determined effort to make sure that Germany remained exactly as you said. Now, that all of those calculations seem to be out the window, certainly in Donald Trump's mind, and he's talked about NATO being a defunct organization or no longer relevant in today's world. And this is part of this kind of smashing of old, the way that we've been doing things for the past 70 years that we're seeing from this administration. What are some ways that the Trump administration threatens to transform this peaceful era that you were just describing?
Well, you could probably break it down into two or three ways. The most direct would be free trade. So we mentioned how America has been really one of the guardians, one of the upholders of free trade, and just encouraging that on the world scene. And few nations have benefited from that as much as Germany. You know, we addressed this a little on Friday's program. Half of Germany's economy almost comes from exports, and their biggest destination right now for exports is America. And so just one very direct way is if he starts putting in tariffs on goods coming into America, starts ending free trade, well, first of all, you just directly hit German trade with America right there. And like I said, Germany's most important destination for imports. Also, you know, Germany wants to grow their economy. Every economy generally aims to be growing by 2 or 3% each year. If Germany's going to do that, so much of their other export markets are in recession, their economy's terrible. America's just about the only positive growing place that they're exporting. They need to be increasing exports to Germany every year. Even if it just stays the same, they're going to face some difficulties. And Donald Trump is out there giving interviews talking about, well, we need to place a 35% tax on BMWs. So that's a very direct threat. And then just by ending American support for global free trade, you start to see the possibility of the doors being closed to Germany in other places. And then that kind of brings us to the European Union, because again, Germany, it needs the European Union for free trade. The euro has really been fantastic in trade terms for Germany. It locked in trade with the rest of Europe that kept German goods at low prices. Without the euro, German goods, both in America but especially within Europe, would be dramatically more expensive. And so their trade explosion and a lot of their economic growth relies upon the euro, relies upon the European Union. Now you have Donald Trump that is reversing America's position on the European Union, where just about every U.S. administration, going back to whoever was in charge of America when John Foster Dulles was in the CIA, has been supporting European integration. They've been pushing this project. They've been behind this project. And they did a lot, for example, to convince Britain to sign up in the 1970s and just to keep things going before then. So the European Union has been operating with America's support, America's blessing. Donald Trump is reversing that and not only does he not like Europe, but you get the sense even that he is going to be working to take Europe down. He's been talked about, you know, I believe others will leave. So Mr. Obama traveled to Britain to try and persuade Britain to stay. He was calling the Greeks. He was calling other ones, you know, stay with Europe. Donald Trump's going to be doing the opposite. Mm-hmm. The speculation, right? And he's talking about really strongly supporting Britain now that Britain has broken away. In some ways, that's really incentivizing other nations to break away. You're holding out, you know, you break away from Europe, we'll help you. come on, then quit the European Union and you can sign this great trade deal with America.
Mm-hmm.
That's what his, in effect, his responsibilities are doing with Brexit. And Spiegel reported, I think just over the weekend, they wrote, officials in Brussels are concerned that one of Trump's foreign policy goals may be that of dividing the EU. So, you know, Germany needs the European Union. It needs the euro for its economy. It's benefited hugely from that. And then Donald Trump is just going, he is almost directly threatening that. And then the final area that we talked, that you mentioned just to come back to, is NATO. And of course, that's kind of been the security protection for Europe. That's been, and that has basically been Europe's defense, especially since the end of the Cold War, where European nations have just been dramatically slashing budget, ending conscription, ending even kind of forces that were there just to slow Russia down. Those have been going. They depend upon Article 5. They depend upon America's promise to Europe that if Russia invades, we will defend you, that collective defense clause.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that umbrella gone, well, then this kind of ends this time that Germany has been able to sit in America's shadow, where they've been able to outsource their defense, where European nations haven't had to maintain a world-class military. That is over. And so now you're faced with the prospect of Germany having to aggressively push its own interests again in a way that we have not seen since World War II.
Okay, well, let's get into that. What exactly are Germany's options here? What are the interests that it has to pursue and to secure? And how might it go about doing that?
Well, one is it has to keep the EU together. And in order to do that, it needs to start keeping the European Union on a common position on things like Russia, on dealing with the euro crisis. And in the past, a lot of that leadership to keep Europe together came from America. You know, why is Europe unified on sanctions against Russia? Well, a good part of the reason is Angela Merkel in Germany, and it is a testament to German power. But it's also a testament to America, and America has done as much, if not more, of the heavy lifting in keeping Europe together on sanctions than Germany has. And so now you're faced with the prospect of Germany alone having to go around to these other EU nations and to persuade them, to cajole them, to even force them to stick with a common position, something that America would have done before. You've got to get all of Europe really looking at defense. And that's something that we've talked about quite a bit on this program. You know, Europe needs to start getting their act together in terms of defense. If the NATO umbrella is pulled, well, then Europe needs to start looking at ways to defend itself. Germany relies on America's nuclear deterrent. Germany, unlike Britain and France, Germany doesn't have its own nuclear weapons. Its only deterrent from a nuclear attack is America's missiles. So it's got to start looking at that. And the picture you're seeing emerging now is a quote-unquote normal country, a country that's completely unrestrained by its past, a country mm-hmm. that is engaged in power politics as every other nation, that has a large army, that has military, that has nuclear weapons, and that is throwing its weight around, is bullying countries, finding leverage, building up power, just the way that Europe has acted for most of its history, because that's the way it has to act without that protector there.
And this is essentially what an America First type of policy coming from a Trump administration is forcing Germany to do. You're talking about Germany really having to work hard at diplomacy, interactions with other European nations in order to preserve the European Union that's so vital to its own interests. And it's thrown into that position because America withdrawing. And essentially, Donald Trump has given Germany his blessing in this. Germany is this unrestrained Germany that you're talking about. This is you could look at this as a direct effect of America taking the position that it is.
Absolutely. You know, America first in the way that Donald Trump means it means that then Germany has to pursue a Germany first mm-hmm. policy. Now, in a lot of ways, I think America has always been pursuing an America first policy. It's just that most presidents have seen it with a much longer range vision than Mr. Trump has. But by taking a much more short-term and narrow interpretation of America's interests, no longer thinking, well, it's in America's long-run interests to keep Germany down, like NATO is there for, by withdrawing from that, they're forcing Germany now to have to step up aggressively and defend itself.
Stephen Fleury was talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio show earlier on the week about this seems like a very strong manifestation of a weakness that America has displayed repeatedly through its history, and that is an inability to recognize the real nature of the threats that it faces, and it focuses on essentially one threat at a time. That's the way Mr. Armstrong put it, that we can only see one threat at a time, and we forget the other threats that are coming behind it. So as we take our eyes off of the ball in those other areas to focus on the one, then we end up really hurting ourselves in the, you know, immediately outside the short term. And in this case, here we are trying to deal with economic woes that the United States is facing, and Donald Trump is trying to get better trade deals for ourselves. And essentially, he's saying we absolutely trust what Europe is going to look like with Germany at the helm, unrestrained. It's going to take care of itself. We're not going to have to be expending the money to look after Europe. They're going to look after their own interests, and this is going to help everyone in the long run. But this is a really short-sighted view. You were talking about what an anomalous period that 70 years of peace was after World War II. When you look at European history in the long run, 70 years of peace is that's not going to last once we move forward.
No, and in a lot of ways, Germany hasn't been living in, say, like the real world for the last 70 years because of that American protection, because America has been there guarding Germany's interests, just to come back to where we were at the start. And I think it's what we're seeing in foreign policy is exactly the same points that Trumpet columnist Brad McDonald has been making on this program when it comes to, for example, Germany's response to the terrorist attacks. And he's talked about, you know, the Germans have what they want to be, unthreatening, prosperous, I think, as he put it, progressive, open-minded, and tolerant. But they're being forced into this much harder, much tougher position by the real world, by these terrorist attacks. And now you see the same thing happening for foreign policy. That protection, that shelter, that shadow of the United States is being lifted. And Germany may well want to pursue a policy where they just work on economic growth and they don't push anyone around too much. They may want that. But we live in an evil world. We live in a world where nations are going to look after only themselves ultimately. And so unless Germany starts guarding its own interest, with America now pursuing a much more narrow America first interest, no one else is going to do it. They're either going to be taken advantage of, or they're going to have to get out there and start taking advantage of other people. And that's what we're looking at now, kind of a return to normalcy, a return to the conditions that we saw within Europe for all of history, like we've been talking about, and just a Germany that's back standing up strongly for itself.
Essentially the same conditions that led to World War I and World War II and other wars.
Exactly. And both of those, immediately preceding both of those wars, what did you see America pursuing? Well, it was even before World War II, it was even called America First. Just the same, we can take our hands off the rest of the world. It doesn't matter. We don't need to get involved because we've got two big oceans either side of us. And what happened on both of those occasions, the rest of the world just spiraled out of control. You can easily see the same thing happening now.
Yep. Well, we've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the effects of a Trump presidency on Europe and particularly on Germany. Richard is finishing up an article for the next edition of the Trumpet print, the Trumpet magazine. It's called Germany Steps Out of America's Shadow. Really excellent article, very important subject that I'm excited to see all of this come together for this. This is the March edition of the Trumpet magazine. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Appreciate you bringing this to us, Richard. It's a great subject to get into.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Israel seems to be pretty excited about the election of Donald Trump. In the final days of the Obama administration, America took some really nasty shots at Israel that put a capstone on an era that was very difficult for the Jewish state. But now it seems they have a friend in the White House, someone they can count on, and it looks like they've already started to take advantage of that fact. To talk about what Israel is doing and what this means for Israel's future, we have Brent Nachtigall via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. The Jerusalem municipal government is back in construction mode. Tell us about
this.
Looks
like it, yes. There was the first phone call between President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday, and immediately after that, we had 500 plus, almost 600 homes that were okayed by the Jerusalem municipality to be built in East Jerusalem. And these were originally okayed by the municipality to go ahead back in December, but they held – well, the vote was going to go back – sorry, it wasn't approved in December. The vote was going to come to the municipality in December, but the government held off just because of all the UN Security Council resolution that was going forward, because Israel had caught wind that the United States was looking to increase their pressure on Israel. So Israel decided we're just going to hold off and not even approve these. Well, Mr. Trump comes into office, and then immediately we have building going ahead in East Jerusalem.
It's been a while since the Jews actually were involved in new construction in these areas, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's been a few instances when there has been construction freezes over the years, in the past 5 or 6 years, as good faith or faith-building measures with the Palestinians to try and get them to the negotiating table. But they have proven not to work, such freezes in the past. But as far out of respect for the Obama administration, or out of concern that it would provoke further ire from the Obama administration, they decided to hold off on these. Just today, actually, we had more construction permits that were granted. Outside of Jerusalem, in the West Bank proper, we had 2,500 new settlement homes, as they're called, that are going to be built in the West Bank in different pre-existing settlements. These aren't new settlements, but these will be new houses that have been approved by the government to be constructed in far-flung regions of the West Bank as well.
And this is really in defiance of the latest UN Security Council resolution.
Yeah, this is exactly the thing that the resolution was going after. One of the PLO spokespeople from the executive branch, they had this to say following the announcement. This was today's announcement. They said, such a deliberate escalation of Israelis' settlement and illegal settlement enterprise constitutes a war crime and the flagrant violation of international law and conventions, in particular UN Security Council Resolution 2334. That's the resolution that was just passed. Mm-hmm. This is in direct contravenance of that resolution, and they're right. It is. Mm-hmm. It's against what that resolution called Israel not to do. But Israel is showing that following a call with a new American president, they don't care about that resolution. They're going to go ahead and build.
And Benjamin Netanyahu, he made a statement after that meeting with Donald Trump that kind of gave the indication that he feels like he's got a green light to build as much as he wants, and directly defying. It seems like this is essentially Israel and America's response to the Obama administration allowing that resolution to pass.
Yeah, I mean, the proximity to the Mr. Obama leaving, the resolution, Mr. Trump getting in power, and then immediately we've got green lights for construction has to be seen in a way as kind of getting back at them, or showing that Israel now feels free to do what they like. As you said, Prime Minister Netanyahu did release a statement on Sunday, and this is what he said about what he feels comfortable doing now. He said there is no longer a need to coordinate construction in the Jewish neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. We can build where we want and as much as we want. That's pretty defiant to the rest of the world and the previous American administration. They're going to build as much as they want and where they want in East Jerusalem. They see it as their unified capital, just like Arabs can put in a permit or try and get a permit to build anywhere. You can have Jews that can get a permit to build anywhere as well, and they're going to go ahead with it.
We have an article on this subject going up on thetrumpet.com by Callum Wood. We weren't able to get him on the program, but he mentioned one other final swipe that the Obama administration took against Israel. I'm not sure how close this was to his final day in office, but maybe you could just tell us about
this. It was on his final day. Yeah, it was a few hours, just a couple hours before the inauguration, when he released, I think it was about $222 million to the Palestinian Authority. This is something that, while Congress had approved it, there were a number of congressmen that had put a hold on it. It wasn't going to go forward. And then the president, he can overrule that. And he decided as one of his final acts to give them an extra $221 million to the Palestinian Authority to use where they will.
So, again, the contrast between the Obama administration and the Trump administration couldn't be more stark. The question is Israel making any kind of strategic miscalculation by taking the words of Donald Trump to the extent that they are and feeling like they have this much confidence that they're going to be able to defy the UN Security Council with impunity, essentially?
Yeah, that is the question, whether Israel can bank on, well, two things. Can Israel bank on Mr. Trump to go ahead and remain a strong ally of Israel? He said that he would. And he looks to be very pro-Israel, but will that change given other pressures that he comes into contact with around the world? You know that the rest of the world voted for, or at least those that were in the Security Council, they did vote for to pass the resolution. Mm-hmm. The United States abstained, but the rest of the world wanted this resolution that really did declare any building of Israel in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank, is illegal. So that is world public opinion. That's what it is. That's fact. But Israel believes that all they need is the support of the United States, and then the rest of the world can think and believe and pass resolutions willy-nilly. But if they have the support of the superpower, Israel's banking on that that's going to be enough. Will it be enough? Whether, you know, the question, as I said, is whether Mr. Trump will guarantee Israel's security, whether Israel has enough of an ally in the United States that the rest of, they can lose their friends in the rest of the world. Israel does want friends, and Israel's been in search for friends for 60 years around the world. And the foreign ministry goes to great lengths to try and foster relationships based on friendship and also needs and economic deals from Israel to other countries to try and foster relationships with other countries. But what we've seen throughout history is a perpetual animus towards Israel, towards the Jews, and a lot of those business ventures haven't come to much. So in light of that, Israel seems to be putting, as even Callum writes in this article, he writes that Israel seems to be putting all their eggs in one basket looking forward, looking to the future. They believe that America is all they need. They will continue to reach out to others, but as long as America's got their back, they will upset the rest of the world and keep on building in East Jerusalem.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about how this might play out. It seems like Netanyahu is expressing an enormous amount of confidence in Donald Trump, and there's not necessarily, I think there are a lot of people who are more cautiously optimistic. You have a lot of people who are hopeful. But Benjamin Netanyahu is actually saying, we're willing to put buildings on the ground in areas where they are explicitly determined by the Security Council to be illegal based on the promise of this relationship, which that's quite an extraordinary level of commitment that he's demonstrated.
Yeah, and there has been a lot of rumbling over the past couple of days here in Israel, whether even Trump's boldest proclamation that he's going to move the embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, the American embassy, whether he's going to go ahead with that, because I think the new press secretary or the new spokesman for the president, Mr. Spicer, he was asked a question about this and he said, well, we're only in the very preliminary discussions about it and nothing's been decided. And people in Israel are taking that as, well, maybe he's not as supportive as we initially thought. That said, the one man who is thinking, as you said, that he is going to get the support from the U.S. and Mr. Trump is Prime Minister Netanyahu. I believe that Mr. Netanyahu would build in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, regardless of Mr. Trump, because he believes that that is Israel's homeland. They have right to that. How dare any other nation come and tell me, tell the Jerusalem municipality, who's going to go over to Washington, D.C. and tell their municipal government, sorry, you can't build there, you can build here, this is illegal, that's not illegal. It's the double standard is ridiculous, and I believe that Mr. Netanyahu would build there anyway. But now that he's got Mr. Trump's support, he is bold with it, and his rhetoric is strong and powerful and defiant, very defiant, to the point that he better watch himself in a way, because he might lose some friends in the way that he's doing this through the act, through how defiant he's being with his rhetoric.
Well, put this in the context of biblical prophecy for us, because obviously this is territory that's extremely volatile. We have quite a lot in this coming edition of The Trumpet that's talking about how important Jerusalem is, and we're put, especially in light of what the Security Council decided. We might actually have to put some of this information in here to make sure that this edition reflects what the facts on the ground now that Donald Trump has taken office. But if you could just tell us how this might play out based on what we know of Bible prophecy.
Well, what we know of Bible prophecy is that Jerusalem, there is going to be a disagreement over Jerusalem with the Palestinians and a lot of the world. And that's already happening. We're seeing that. But that was in the Bible. But half of Jerusalem will eventually fall into Palestinian hands. And when that happens, according to prophecy, and we've got plenty of books that people can read, Jerusalem and Prophecy being the foremost one that gives the background to this. But when that happens, Israel is going to look for an ally, somebody to come and support them to hold off or at least maintain the peace between Israel and the Palestinians over Jerusalem. And the United States is not that peacekeeper. Mm-hmm. There is another nation that is invited in, and that is Germany, is going to be invited in to Jerusalem to maintain peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians because of this split of Jerusalem. Now, that tells you a couple of things. It tells you that that America is not able to do that, or Israel doesn't want America to do that, and they choose Germany. We've talked about how America might be in a difficult situation itself domestically, that it is unable to help Israel at that point, and so they go to Germany for help. We don't necessarily know the exact details that are going to lead to that, but that's definitely where this is going.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Brent Nachtigall from Jerusalem. We have an article up on thetrumpet.com by Callum Wood called Trump Effect, Israel Approves East Jerusalem Building Permits, and that you can find online at thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent, in light of us not being able to get hold of Callum, but we're getting it right from the source here in terms of the geography.
I'm glad to fill in and talk about Jerusalem whenever you need.
Appreciate your time.
Yep, bye-bye.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We all enjoy music, but are you getting as much enjoyment out of the music you listen to as you can? This radio station and the Trumpet Magazine operate on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College in Edmond, Oklahoma. We also have Imperial Academy here, a K through 12 school. The director of all the musical activities in these schools is a man named Ryan Malone. He's a very prolific composer, an accomplished pianist and singer. He also runs the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation's concert series here at Armstrong Auditorium. He wants to help you love music even more than you do, and he hosts a show on Trumpet Radio each week called Music for Life. I talked with him about the purpose of that program, what he's accomplishing with it, and how it can help you appreciate and enjoy music more. Here's our conversation. So, Ryan, I have this article. This came out, this is last December in The Atlantic. It's called The Shazam Effect, and it's really interesting article just talking about the democratization of popular music and how it's no longer the record labels and it's no longer the DJs that are determining what's popular more than ever before because of technology. It's the user that has the largest say in what's really popular. It's really easy for them to track what people are listening to, what they like. So the result is all of this metadata that they are collecting about what people want to listen to is that people want to hear the same songs over and over. They want to hear them more often. They're not as interested in new things. The content creators are taking this information and realizing, well, if this is what people want, this is what we're going to give them. And the music is becoming more and more the same. 2012 Spanish National Research Council released a report that showed that pop is becoming increasingly bland, loud, and predictable, recycling the same few chord progressions over and over. They say our brains are wired to prefer melodies that we already know. Is, say, your effort in education to try to counteract some of that predisposition that we may have to just want the same thing?
Oh, definitely. We have to counteract it. We have to stretch our minds. I think we've come so far in our society down this road of music is there just for enjoyment that it's the equivalent of what's happened kind of in the food industry where it's like, well, now food needs to taste good. And that's it. We've stripped out any discussion of the value of it in terms of our bodily health or our mental health. And all we're focused on is, well, it tastes good. We do like things that are familiar. I mean, that our brains love that. I think, great composers have done a good job of somewhat of a more, maybe a sophisticated form of that Shazam effect of taking things that we know that are going to be successful or that are going to be, pleasing, but then encasing it in something just really high quality. So there's something to be said for, well, yeah, we want to hear familiar things and we can cater to that to some degree, but then you have the corporate entities trying to just make money. And whenever you try to just be commercially successful with something, whether it be with music or anything, or like we said earlier with food, I mean, you're going to start sacrificing other things on that altar that we could miss out on. And our job is to dig into these things that make our existence great and find those things of depth that really do enrich our minds and don't just, that don't just cater to, the hitting the pleasure button.
Can you give us an idea of how education enriches a person's experience with music?
That really is the argument for any discipline, education in any discipline. I mean, if you know this about history, well, then your life is better. you know how to avoid this or to follow the same path. I mean, there's that law of history there. I mean, there's something really just magnificent about this ordering of tones, this ordering of pitches, which brings together science and mathematics. And then there's this emotional impact that comes out of it. And how do we explain that? How can we take that apart and understand that more deeply? And the more we understand about it, the more enriching it is, and the more you discover and the more excitement there is in seeing those components.
If you contrast, say, the feeling that you get in appreciating something on an intellectual level versus listening to something and saying, wow, that song hits me emotionally. Maybe it was because of what you were experiencing the first time you heard that piece of music, or something that is really divorced from any inherent meaning within the music itself. There's just that emotional response. What's the difference between these two, and why would we aspire to, well, I really want to make sure that intellectual component is a part of my experience as a listener.
I think the intellectual component is a valuable part of the emotional content. When you understand, oh, that composer is using that technique and that I didn't expect that. It went over here instead of what I was expecting it to do. And then when it finally did go where I wanted it, oh, that was just so much more gratifying. There are, the more you understand about those components, the more you do have that emotional response to it. For someone to say, oh, we call that a deceptive cadence. And well, okay, well, that's a pretty intellectual label. But there's something really emotionally gripping about a deceptive cadence. And when you hear it and you recognize it, oh, wow, what a great deceptive cadence, then that adds to your emotional value.
In the classical era, they introduced sonata form. And from what I understand, this is basically like a means of bringing in elements of drama, a means of bringing in characters and interplay among characters and establishing expectations in the mind of the listener, and then playing with those in ways that are similar to watching a movie or seeing a play or something that is more overtly dramatic. Is how much of, say, the intellectual appreciation of a piece of music that you're talking about is a matter of understanding the rules so that you can discern how the composer is playing with them or stretching the rules, or, to what degree he's fulfilling expectations and to what degree he's smashing expectations?
That really is almost everything of how to get the most satisfaction from music intellectually, emotionally, mentally, that you have, okay, the sonata form, as you're talking about, two melodies being contrasted, being played with, being presented very matter-of-factly, set in a very symmetrically balanced order. And every first movement of every sonata, almost to a T, going by that cookie cutter format, that very simple, like these are very simple melodies that my ear can, I hear that tune, I can recognize it if I hear it again, knowing how the composers play with those themes. And then knowing that when Beethoven comes along and he starts really monkeying with it, well, now I know that Beethoven is great, not just because everybody talks about him or just because, well, I like how that Fifth Symphony sounds, but I know, wow, he was really messing with it, and he was really shattering expectations and challenging the conventional notion of, what was happening with music as you would have heard, just in the aristocratic events in the background.
Is it a somewhat similar type of a situation, maybe just on a more elevated scale to what you might experience in a pop song? You're listening to a pop song and you're saying, I think it's going to do this, or I think it's going to repeat this many times, but oh, they changed it in this way. Oh, there's that space. Now it went up a key or whatever. Maybe they're playing with a simpler set of rules, but it's still about expectation and either fulfillment or surprise.
Right, or delaying that expectation. Definitely, those pop songwriters who use those methods in their piece, they certainly have the same components that the classical music has. It reminds me of what Lenny Bernstein said, that there are only two types of music, good music and bad music. There is quality music to be found in every genre of music, whether it's a a folk tune of, you know, of this village in Poland, or whether it's, you know, a pop song on the radio today that shatters some of these harmonic expectations that we really, wow, why do I like that so much? Oh, it's because it does this. Or between, you know, what Beethoven did, you know, with his Third Symphony or something like that. It's they're the same methods, the same methodology being employed. It's just a different context or scenario for which the music has been written. So you certainly can find those types of things in the popular tradition, you know, and in the folk tradition. And certainly those things, you know, I personally find satisfying.
You work with children. You have a captive audience. What do you do to engage them? And is there some of that that you employ, say, in the classroom setting that you can transfer over into trying to engage a wider audience that you feel like will really keep people and really make them excited about what they might learn on your radio program?
Well, I'm bringing a friend into the room, and I'm showing everyone my friend, and I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, this is so-and-so, this is what they're like, and I'd like you to meet them, and I'd like you to get to know them. Whether it's children or whether it's an adult, I'm introducing them to something that I've grown fond of, you know, to an art form or to a piece of music that certainly I like, that I find value in, and so I can introduce them. They can see that excitement in me that, wow, I'm really excited about this type of element or this type of musical activity or musical technique. That can be communicated, that passion, that love, that excitement for, you know, come meet my friend, he's awesome, you know, and this is why. I think no matter what age, and particularly with a younger age, not just because they have to sit there, but because they are, no one's told them otherwise that they shouldn't or should like this, that they can be shown this and keep hearing it and thinking, yeah, why I really like that. Or and then it becomes familiar to them. And then when they get in their 20s and 30s, you know, the studies that say, well, it has to be familiar melodies. Well, guess what? There's a huge gamut of repertoire that is familiar melodies to these young children.
Can you give us a quick rundown of the range of subjects that you're planning to cover and the things that you're really excited, these friends that you're really excited to share with your listeners?
There'll be shows on, you know, musical instruments, on types of compositions like descriptive music. There'll be shows on things that have influenced music, music and monarchs, music written for kings, how the patrons of the arts have affected music history, the folk influence on music.
It's not just about understanding what's behind a particular composition, but you're really setting music into its cultural and historical context. And so a listener is going to come to appreciate what they're hearing as a piece of history.
Absolutely. Because it's all part of the human experience. You know, just thinking about how did Ludwig von Beethoven affect how big a compact disc was, you know, and that's a fact of music history. And it's an exciting thing to see how music impacts other things in the world and how the world impacts music. What did the Age of Enlightenment, the Declaration of Independence have to do with sonata form? What did that have to do with melody? That we can talk about things like that. So people who have an interest in history or math or science, there are things of interest to all disciplines, I believe, and tying them in with music that I think will be exciting on some level for anyone to enjoy.
You can listen to Music for Life at 4 o'clock on Mondays, Central Standard Time, or you can find it online at thetrumpet.com. If you just go over to the radio tab, and you can find all of the programs, including Ryan Malone's Music for Life. Give it a listen. Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
As I was putting my son to bed one night, he was 6 years old at the time, he asked, "Can we wrestle for a few minutes?" I had other things I needed to get to, but just that day, I had written in my journal, "I need to wrestle with Noah more. Make this a priority." This moment of decision happens all the time, me or family. Do what I need to do or just want to do, or devote my time to my children or my wife. Perhaps the men out there can identify, and I'd like to talk directly to you. For a husband and dad, what you do in that moment is more consequential than you probably realize. Making the selfish choice in that moment is the number one thing that holds us back from being better husbands and fathers. What's more, it contradicts the role God gave to us men to fill in the lives of our wives and children. The love of God is the way of give. The spirit of God's law is to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and to love your fellow man as much as you love yourself. That's what it says in Matthew 22. That's the spirit of God's law. The spirit of the opposite of that, the spirit of sin, is simply to love self first. Husbands and fathers need to judge ourselves by this standard. Am I loving myself right now instead of my family? The beautiful truth is the roles of husband and father are the exact instruments we need to overcome and to grow in this critical area of character. When we men fulfill these roles, we demolish our selfishness like a sledgehammer crushing rock. Think, God created the roles of a husband and a father in order to shape his character in us. The Bible likens Jesus Christ to a husband and God to a father. God wants you to realize that in your family, you fulfill a type of God and a type of Christ. At the core of these roles is the number one thing that can help all of us men conquer our selfishness and be better husbands and fathers, and that is sacrifice. The Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians 5, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it." A godly husband demonstrates his love for his wife through sacrifice. How did you give yourself to your wife today? In what way did you truly sacrifice for her this week? John 3:16 says, "For God the Father so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life." A godly father demonstrates love for his children through sacrifice, giving them the best he has to give. The Bible details the major aspects of a man's role, serving as his family's protector, provider, guide, educator, disciplinarian, and love giver. All these duties revolve around our noble obligation to sacrifice. Ask yourself, what is preventing me from truly fulfilling the roles of husband and father in my family? Sure, we have priorities that demand our attention outside the home. We must be providers. We should be builders within the community. And this absorbs our energies and time. But if we're balanced and we do these things out of godly sacrificial love, they actually enhance our standing as husbands and fathers. Where the problem comes in is when we choose to put our selfish interests first. This deprives our families of the physical, emotional, and spiritual benefits God wants to provide them through us as men. And it squanders our opportunity to use our family responsibilities to forge godly character. What are some practical ways you can emulate the husband of all husbands today? How can you give your one and only precious wife the marriage experience God wants her to have? And how can you imitate the father of all fathers today? How can you provide your children the family experience that will turn their hearts to their spiritual father? Make a list. Maybe it's calling her to say you're thinking of her, fixing what's broken, expressing your appreciation, picking up after yourself. leading family Bible studies, washing the dishes, hanging that family portrait, taking them out when you sense she's overwhelmed, helping with homework, teaching a skill, being big fun dad, going for a family walk, tackling a family project, giving an unexpected gift, snuggling, planning a getaway, wrestling with your boy. Do something off of that list every day. Make another list of things you do that swallow your time and draw you away from being that godly husband and father, disappearing into your study, not listening, being distracted, burying your nose in your smartphone, spending too much time on the computer, getting impatient, bringing work home, getting lost in sports, contributing nothing. Study that list. Ask yourself, is anything here worth putting in front of my family? And the next time you encounter that moment of decision, me or family, make a different choice. Do the unselfish thing. Sacrifice. Just like the ultimate husband and father do for you. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests today, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Ryan Malone. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Calvin Coolidge. No person was ever honored for what he received. Honor has been the reward for what he gave. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.